Hi, everybody, and welcome to my Saturday podcast, where we get, I've got a couple of repeat guests, people that come on 2-3 times a year. Michael Mulvihill is one of those. He is a head of strategy, which is a very sophisticated title. Like, I'm on the treadmill day to day trying to break down topics. Guys that are the head of strategy, you can read thick books. He's a Fox Sports executive vice president. You can have days when you wander around halls and just come up with ideas. Is that what head of strategy does?
I think you make it sound a little loftier than it might actually be. I mean, really all I am is just a TV ratings wonk, and I just dig into data every day and try to come up with something interesting to say. Well, thank you for making it sound like more than it really is.
Head of strategy is unbelievable. Let's start with the small stuff before we get into some politics and NFL stuff. XFL. I think the aesthetics are good. I can remember having a discussion with somebody a year ago at this company, and I said, what's a number? And they said, listen, you get 750,000 people a game, you'd have to be happy with that in year one. Where are the numbers? What are the expectations? Where are we at with the XFL?
So where the numbers are, you know, we're obviously 4 weeks into the season. We started with week one, our games doing close to 3.5 million viewers, which I think was far above anybody's expectation. And it's tailed off a little bit in each successive week, which was in line with expectations. You know, what I thought would happen was that we would premiere in the 2 to 3 million range and then fall off by, you know, a significant percentage in week two and then smaller percentages thereafter. Well, the trend line has followed that, but we've started from a higher week one base than we expected to. So we're still ahead of expectations. I felt coming into the season that there were really three questions that the XFL needed to answer, and I think they've all been answered positively. One was, could this version of the XFL separate itself from the previous iteration?
Yes, because right? There's some cynicism in the marketplace. This stuff doesn't work.
Right. And so could you establish that this was not the XFL that, you know, some viewers might remember from 20 years ago? I think that indisputably has happened.
Yeah,
it's clearly separated.
The leadership is, to me, Oliver Luck changes the temperature in the room. This is a long-term play with a real grown-up running it. Doesn't feel gimmicky at all, but it doesn't also feel like a farm system. It feels like a league that is just going to get better and better. That's what it feels like to me as a consumer.
Yeah, just as a fan, I think it's a very watchable brand of football, and I think the level of access that they've brought to the broadcast, and we've tried to contribute to that, has been really positive. I'll take you back to Super Bowl Sunday. I had an opportunity during the Super Bowl to watch the game while listening to the live mics that were being worn by Mahomes and Shanahan, Kelsey, Kittle. It's an amazing experience, incredible way to watch football. You think, God, it would be incredible if just the average viewer sitting at home could experience this. And with the XFL, they do. You know, you are getting that live audio from head coaches and officials and coordinators,
yeah.
And it's a really fascinating way to watch the game. So I think in those ways, the league has really separated itself from other spring football leagues. Going back to that idea of three questions that had to be answered, that was one. I think another was that in the home markets, could the XFL prove that it belongs in the same conversation as well-established local teams, whether that's an NHL team, NBA, a high-profile college basketball team? You know, could the XFL be a credible part of the local sports conversation? That definitely has happened.
Yeah, Seattle, you know, and Houston, there's some places drawing.
Absolutely. You know, you're doing a 7 rating in Seattle, a 7 rating in St. Louis.
Those are
great sports towns.
Yeah, by the way, for those listening, a 7 rating, the Rams in Los Angeles can struggle to get that. So a 7 rating for an XFL game in its initial year is pretty noteworthy.
Yeah, just to be clear about what that means. So that's 7% of the homes in a city tuning into an XFL game at the same time. That's a pretty good number. That's about as good as what you're seeing for anything in primetime entertainment, and it's as good as a lot of major long-running sports properties. So that was question two. And then question three was, could we do national ratings that are as good as properties that have been viable for a long time? We definitely have. You know, I think what most people sometimes overlook is that of the thousands of sports events that are on national television every year, you know, about 100 of them are opportunities to watch the NFL, and another 100 are opportunities to watch other jewel events, things like the World Series and the NBA Finals and the Masters.
Yeah.
And then once you get beyond that top level, the vast majority of national sports programming kind of lives in that range of 1 to 3 million viewers on a big broadcast network or 1 to 2 million viewers on a cable network. And that's an area where you can really do business just fine, and you can thrive and grow in value. And properties like MLS and the English Premier League and every major college basketball conference, you know, they've been drawing viewership in that range for a long time, and all they do is increase in value. So for the XFL to be in that range, I think is really healthy.
NFL ratings increased again this year, 5%. The NBA, to me, has always felt like a story league. We don't really watch the regular season. Adam Silver, according to a source I have in the NBA, had told somebody years ago, we all know the secret. People watch the playoffs. They love free agency. But, you know, the regular season, it's about stories. People don't really show according to the data. They sit and watch 2.5 hours of game action on a nightly basis. We do watch the NFL. We sit down, we bet it, we watch it, we have fantasy football, and we watch it to the end. We'll watch bad games to the end. We'll watch bad teams. I was drawn into Baker Mayfield in Cleveland this year, mm-hmm. Sam Darnold and the Jets. I don't watch bad NBA teams. I'll watch bad NFL teams. So it was up 5%. That's in a Trump presidency, which is an emotional, day-to-day free-for-all. It's a tug-of-war. It's a fistfight. Is the 5%... in this day and age, were you guys blown away with it? Was it on target? What was the takeaway inside this building on that?
It was probably somewhere in between on target and blown away. You know, that's a little bit better than expectation, but it's not so far beyond expectation that you feel like you missed your projections or you just had the whole thing miscalculated. Look, I would say that the NBA, more than any other league, is driven by stars and individuals. Major League Baseball, more than any other league, is driven by the brands of the teams and not by individuals. And the NFL exists somewhere in between, right? It's driven by both big brands and individual players. And what's lifting the NFL right now is that the most important brands, the brands that really drive viewership, all had interesting seasons last year. The Cowboys ultimately didn't make the playoffs, but they were in it from start to finish.
Hey, the Giants moved off Eli. They were lousy and interesting.
That's another one. Green Bay won 13 games and got a bye. New England is always going to be interesting as long as they have that coach and that quarterback. So the brands delivered, and then on top of that, you've got this infusion of talent at the quarterback position, which I think is the position across all of sports that drives the most interest and drives the most viewership. And now that you have this generation of quarterbacks led by Patrick Mahomes, now a Super Bowl champion, I think that raises interest as well. And that's only going to get better because we're now coming up to a draft where at least two more really interesting quarterbacks are about to enter the league. I can't remember a time where there's been so much depth of interesting storylines, to your point, and quality play at the quarterback position as there is right now. Combine that with the fact that the big brands are delivering, and we're going to have an interesting story in Dallas this year just by virtue of the new head coach. It really adds up to a favorable scenario for the NFL.
Confirmation bias is very apparent. I try to avoid it, but I can be guilty of it, where I have a belief system and then I see data which I make confirm my agenda or my bias. I don't think I have agendas, but I do have biases. I like the NBA, and I always have. Those who don't will say it's down 12%. It's all because of LeBron, China, and politics. I do not believe that to be true. I think young people like the NBA, for the record, young people like the NFL too, but young people like the NBA, they move to devices. It's become more of a highlight league than a watch-every-game league. That could hurt ratings. It's getting more international, which is great for business, but I don't know who Luka is. I know who Zion is. He played at Duke. I mean, Dwayne Wade, I watched him in an Elite Eight at Marquette. When leagues get more international, it could be good for global growth. Doesn't mean I know the players. I'm just getting, you know, I like to watch players in college. Mm-hmm. So I could say, well, the league's getting very international. Kids watch games on their devices. I could say Adam Silver chose to put all his games on cable. Where I think you could make an argument if you had a combination of a broadcast network and cable, NFL's got that, it's healthier. So I don't want any confirmation bias. I want to go to the head of strategy, somebody that looks at these numbers. 12% down, 20% the last 2 years, those are real numbers. What's going on?
So let's start with something really positive, right? The NBA, I think, has the greatest star-making machinery and star-making capability of any league in the world, right? And I think that goes back through most of our lifetime. That goes back to Bird and Magic, and it's been true ever since. And so the NBA has that capability to take their best players and turn them into global icons in a way that baseball and the NFL, yeah, and really only the top European football clubs have a similar capability. So that's really positive.
You wear an NBA player. You wear their shoes.
Right. So I did want to kind of start that with in a really positive way. I guess connected to that is that when you have that incredible star-making machinery, it means that your success as a media property is very much linked to those superstars being healthy and being on the court and producing at a really high level. And I think there are all these theories and pet ideas and agenda-driven ideas around the NBA storyline this year, and it's really just as simple as it's a star-driven league. It's to their benefit that they are a star-driven league. But when half of the biggest stars aren't on the court, there's going to have to be some implications of that. And so when you have Curry not on the court, Durant not on the court, Zion missing most of the season or much of the season, that has to have an impact. I don't believe that that points to an underlying issue at all. We don't have a relationship on a national level with the NBA, so I don't have a business-driven agenda in saying that. I think it's really just as simple as the league is reliant on 5 to 10 superstar athletes who resonate around the world and with younger sports fans. And when you take half of those personalities out of the mix for most of the season, it's going to show up in the numbers.
Yeah. You know, sports, Michael Mulvihill is joining me, Fox Sports Executive VP, Head of Strategy. In my life, sports have ebbed and flowed. Boxing was big. UFC emerged. It sort of went off the table. It's back now when you have DAZN, Fox, ESPN, Plus, all want boxing content. So the business seeking content, boxing to me has always been more elegant, not necessarily better, more elegant than UFC. I grew up with boxing. Most of us over 40 grew up with boxing. Mm-hmm. So boxing's making a little bit of a comeback. Horse racing, which you love, mm-hmm, they've got controversies. It's not daily or even monthly content. It's very niche. You got three races that you got to watch. It feels like it is, unless you're a horse player, it's gone down a little bit. Baseball's lost some of its water cooler social currency because of the volume of games. NFL still feels massive. When you look at these sports, they're going up and they're going down. UFC, by the way, now has gone behind a paywall primarily. Right. Does that help or hurt long term? I look at college basketball today, and I say to myself, what the hell is it? The best high school players don't really want to be in it. It's the apartment complex of sports. Nobody really wants to be in one. You're looking to get a house. The minute you land in an apartment complex, you go through the realtor magazines because you want to buy a condo or stay in one. What's the future of college basketball? What do the numbers say? It feels like it's become a three-week bracket more than a sport. Now, the Big Ten this year had some very compelling teams, and Duke is always a story. Mike Krzyzewski has complained about this. Mm-hmm. What are we as a sport? What, 10 years from now, is it just now a bracket? Is that what the sport's become? A marvelous three-week visceral connection to a betting pool?
So I'm going to answer that question in a way that's maybe a little larger than college basketball. Okay. And we can talk about college basketball specifically, right? But the fundamental premise that guides everything that we're doing at this company is that the entire video industry is reorganizing into two marketplaces. I think you've heard me say this before because I talk about it all the time. The whole video business is reorganizing along lines of live content and on-demand content. And the live content obviously includes all of live sports. It includes all the programming that we do on FS1. It's your 24-hour cable news. And your on-demand content is everything that is scripted and pre-produced and used to run in a primetime network schedule at the whim of programmers like us. Now, more and more, it's watched at the leisure of the consumer via an on-demand platform like Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, now Disney+. Because the market is separating into live and on-demand, the on-demand world primarily has been about advertising avoidance, right? Those platforms are either commercial-free or people are watching their favorite shows via DVR and they're avoiding the ads. Whereas in the live world, because it's live content that you're watching in real time, you can't avoid the ads and our content takes on more value because of the inability to avoid advertising and marketing. All of that is a setup for me to say that college basketball is going to continue to grow in value, going to continue to grow in stature, and I think it's going to be able to hold its audience, if not grow it. We're actually up this year in college basketball, so that's good news. But because college basketball is just part of this larger trend in which all live sports content takes on additional value as scripted content goes to these new platforms, that's just a rising tide that lifts the entire business.
So you think college basketball is okay at some level? March Madness sells. Big Ten basketball has viewers. So does Kansas, Kentucky, and Duke.
All of sports is going to be healthy at some level just because there's a rising tide and a tailwind behind live sports content. I'll give you a stat that you'll like. 93 of the 100 most watched shows of 2019 were live sports events. If you were to go back 20 years, that number was more like 20 to 25. That shows an enormous shift in the highest end of the TV marketplace away from scripted content and toward live content. So that obviously benefits the NFL, but it also benefits the NBA. It benefits college basketball. It benefits horse racing. It benefits boxing when boxing's not in a pay-per-view environment. Everything that's on a commercially sponsored platform that is live sports is benefiting from this evolution of the business. So college basketball is going to be healthy. Every property that we're in business with is likely to continue to grow in value in some way, whether they're realizing that value from a broadcast network or a cable network or an over-the-top service. I think if you work in a sports organization at any level, pro, collegiate, whatever, you probably have a bright future in terms of the value of your media content. As far as college basketball specifically, I mean, I do think there are some challenges there in terms of
a lot of volume,
and the top players being in a rush to enter the draft, and it hurts the consumer's ability to get to know these players before they reach the NBA. But all that said, I think once you get outside of football season, if you're talking about the most important events on the American sports calendar, you know, outside of fourth quarter, you'd probably start that conversation with March Madness. I don't think that's going to change.
Mike Mulvihill is joining us. Does Netflix? I bought Starbucks and Nike stock 10 years ago. Why? I consumed it. I wore their shoes and I drank their coffee. I watch Netflix. Not much in the football season. I just don't have time for it. Mm-hmm. And I'm noticing this. NFL season ends February. I join my wife watching series. Narcos Mexico season 2. Just watched McMillions on HBO Now, actually, I think it was. Is that TV has never been better. In fact, I watch way more TV than movies, and the gap has never been greater. I don't go to a movie theater. I wait for it to come to my home theater. The Netflix, HBO, Showtime, Hulu, Paramount. I wonder if that does that stuff affect sports viewing numbers, ratings? I don't move there in the football season. I got to give my wife, if I take Sundays and Thursdays and Mondays for the NFL, I can't tell my wife on Tuesday, "Honey, I'm watching an NBA game." Mm-hmm. I got to give my wife Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday night. How does when we program stuff, do we think about Netflix?
In some cases, we do. I think the truth is that our understanding of how people use Netflix is pretty limited, and it's because all of that data that Netflix is able to compile,
they don't give it to us.
They keep it to themselves, right?
Like XM Sirius for years in radio. We don't really know how many people listen to XM Sirius.
So the measurement of the TV audience as conducted by Nielsen is relatively transparent. You know, when we subscribe to the Nielsen data, I'm able to track how our own programming is doing, but I also can get a pretty good sense of how things are performing on ESPN and on NBC and on any nationally rated network. It gives us some pretty good visibility into the competition, and they have that same transparency into our programming. We don't have that visibility at all, or we have it in very, very limited ways into that on-demand, subscription-driven world. So we don't know as much about what's driving Netflix's success as we know about what drives ESPN's success. Now, that's evolving, and we're starting to get a little bit of a peek behind the curtain. We do think about, you know, ways that we might be able to account for Netflix viewing. For example, my suspicion is that Netflix has less of an impact on the Sunday afternoon NFL packages, us and CBS, than it has on the primetime NFL packages. And we're a primetime rights holder too, so that affects us as well. It's really hard for me to prove that conclusively with data because the data just isn't there yet. But it is something we talk about, you know, when we talk about what the next round of NFL deals might look like, what the future of NFL consumption might look like. My belief is that primetime maybe is going to be more impacted than Sunday afternoon, and we have to think of ways that we might try to account for that.
Yeah, that's interesting. That would hurt, by the way, NBA, hockey, nighttime viewing. Football's mostly day viewing.
That's correct.
That could be part of that 12% down, could it not?
Again, like it's a credible guess. It's a good theory. It's not something that we can actually provide data to back up.
Yeah.
But you do wonder if there's going to be an advantage to being an afternoon rights holder in the NFL or an afternoon player in college football. We moved our best college football games to noon Eastern this year. We saw a lot of success in that.
Mm.
Is Netflix viewing in primetime a small possible contributor to that? You know, it could be. It could be. I think it's something we just have to keep on our radar and try to get more and better data around the streaming use.
Michael Mulvihill, Fox Sports Executive VP, Head of Strategy. That is a remarkable title.
I just sit here and stroke my chin.
Super Tuesday. Joe Biden won in states he didn't visit. He won in states he didn't campaign in. He had more support in Virginia, where he had one small field office, than Bernie had in his home state of Vermont. What does that say? What were Democrats saying to me? What were they saying to the world?
This is going to be my stick to sports moment. This is going to be when people get on Twitter and tell me to stop talking about politics and just stay to sports TV ratings,
you're
right?
Very good at this stuff.
But just as a lifelong Democrat and an active citizen and somebody who's really interested in politics and elections, I do try to follow it pretty closely. The thing that I thought was the most interesting about Super Tuesday and about the South Carolina primary that preceded it was that the entire election turned, in my opinion, on the fact that older African-American Democrats in South Carolina showed up and rejected one vision for the future of the Democratic Party,
Bernie,
and embraced a more centrist vision
and
a familiar personality
in
Joe Biden. And I think that's so interesting. I really am a believer that in many ways, the credit has to go to the people who actually show up and participate. And in this case, you had a demographic, again, older people, African-American, Democrats in maybe the most red state in the entire country. That's a demographic that's pretty marginalized in the national political dialogue. There aren't a lot of people among the powers that be that are seeking out the opinions of those voters. And yet they showed up on Saturday night for that South Carolina primary, and they absolutely transformed this election.
Yeah.
And they took what seemed to be a foregone conclusion that the Democratic nominee was going to be Bernie Sanders and completely pivoted away from that. And we now seem to be very much on a track toward Joe Biden being the nominee. And it's all because these people who are rarely reached out to and rarely listened to showed up and made themselves heard and engineered an enormous upset. I think it's actually kind of inspiring. And if Joe Biden does go on to be the nominee and maybe goes on to win the general, you're going to look back at that Saturday night and that small group of people who showed up and exercised their hard-earned right to vote and absolutely transformed the campaign. It's a really fascinating story.
Also, late voters, people who made up their mind in the last day, went Biden.
Yes.
Perhaps on the fence thinking, what, he's our best shot to beat Trump?
Yeah, I think there's an old chestnut in politics that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line, right? And Republicans, they just have a much greater willingness to
overlook,
get behind their candidate.
Yes.
And
my wife and
unite,
I talk about this all the time.
Right, and unite in the interest of winning an election. And Democrats, for better or for worse, often seem to be more interested in looking for a savior. And looking for this incredibly dynamic, once-in-a-generation personality, and maybe are a little bit less willing to overlook the flaws and disagreements that come with most candidates. This seems to be a year where Democrats are going to fall in line. You know, my belief is that the idea that Dems fall in love and the GOP falls in line, that idea is going to fall apart this year. And you're already seeing the party coalesce behind a candidate that they believe can win, and that the most important priority is simply winning and moving beyond the current administration. I mean, you're seeing it in the fact that Mike Bloomberg, in dropping out, has said that he's going to continue to spend his own money aggressively in the interest of a Democratic victory. That's a level of unity that we've rarely seen in our party, and certainly haven't seen this early in the cycle.
Michael, I thought what Bloomberg did, this is my takeaway, is 6 months ago he saw Biden struggling, and he thought, I got to get this train back on the centrist track. He enters the race, centers it, and really had no—I don't think he wanted to be president. I think he wanted to get it back in the fairway. When Biden showed strength, Bloomberg's like, listen, I would have lost $600 million in the new tax plans. It's a wash. But I got it back to a centrist, which I think Bloomberg is politically. So people look at Bloomberg as it's a loss. I think he sees it as a huge win and a $600 million loss, which over the course of his life, if it beats Trump, is exactly, it will be worth every penny to Mike Bloomberg. The minute he could leave was the minute centrist Joe Biden appeared to have the momentum. Is that crazy? Felt like that?
No, I don't think that's crazy at all. I mean, I think there are a number of people that want to bring the party back closer to the center and just want to bring the whole dialogue back toward this broad center and have a more kind of rational, civil conversation around politics. And you're seeing it from Biden supporters. I think your comments about Bloomberg are really interesting, and I think that he has an opportunity to establish a legacy for himself in national politics without really winning a significant number of votes.
That's right.
And I think that ultimately, although the primary campaign was at times, you know, spirited and a little bit aggressive, in the end, Buttigieg and Klobuchar also kind of came to that center and said it's a moment for us to unite behind the idea of winning being the top priority. And I think that's where we are now.
Yeah, it's, you know, social media, I have a teenage daughter. Social media, the ramifications with it are, they can be at times daunting. I think it has pulled both political parties. You have to be really steadfast in your belief system because it constantly pulls at me as a parent. It pulls at my daughter. It pulls at political parties. It's noisy. I mean, it's very easy to just take pictures of yourself all day if you're attractive, right? It's very easy to get lost. My wife and I sometimes I'll look up at 4 p.m. waiting for dinner, and we're sitting there just staring at our phones, not talking, because we're just keeping up with the coronavirus, with the Super Tuesday, or I'm keeping up with sports and reading The Athletic. And I think it's really important in a world of social media pulling people away from the centrist sort of mantras that I believe in, that leadership, I think the Democrats had it actually a great week. It was a great week that they went, listen, we had fun, but that's not who we are. You know, Bill Maher's been venting about this stuff. Obama acknowledged a year ago, woke on social media is not solving anything. Go to a soup kitchen. Go do something. And I think it's a danger. I think social media can amplify messages, but it can also pull you out of common sense. That's how I always see it. Like, I tell my staff all the time, we never produce a show on Twitter. It's noisy. It can give us new ideas. It shouldn't be our belief system.
Yeah, that's such a rich topic, and it's something we think about all the time. And this is probably an opportunity to bring the conversation back from politics towards sports, because social media has a similar impact on both. It can really be a funhouse mirror, and it can distort your view of reality. I think social media has done some incredibly positive things. I don't think the Me Too movement happens without social media amplifying voices that had previously not really been heard. But I also think it has a very distorting effect, and it can lead you to have a misinterpretation of reality. And we have to look for those moments where real data, scientific data, or real observed behavior in the world outside social media leads us to a more accurate understanding than social media might. We see it in sports all the time. You know, I'm active on Twitter. You're active at a level multiple times greater than mine, orders of magnitude greater than mine. You see that distorting effect all the time.
Yeah.
And I think, again, going back to the South Carolina primary, we saw it this weekend where social media might have led you to believe that the Democratic Party was drifting one way, but the actual behavior of people who in the real world show up and vote led us to a very different conclusion, and I think a conclusion that now has positioned the party in a much more favorable way in terms of going on to win the general. So that disconnect between what we hear in the noise of social media and what we observe in the world at large can be a wide gap, and I think we really have to discipline ourselves to pay more attention to what's actually happening in the real world and less attention to the noise and the chatter that's generated by social media.
By the way, you look great. You must have lost 25, 30, 40 pounds. What's going on with you?
Keep going. I mean, it's a radio audience. They can't see me.
100 pounds. You said you cut back on sugar.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's a California lifestyle or what, but yeah, a little bit healthier, cutting back on sugar intake, and you know, just the stress of working for this company is causing me to wither away.
You're one of my favorite guys. Michael Mulvihill, Fox Sports Executive VP, Head of Strategy here on our Saturday podcast. You can follow him on Twitter. He doesn't post a lot, but it's always data-driven. I've gotten back, during the political season, I go to 538 a lot.
Yeah,
I think they do a terrific job. Mm-hmm. Their sports stuff I'm hot and cold on, but it's at Mulvihill 79, M-U-L-V-I-H-I-L-L 79. Did you graduate college, high school, something? What is that?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, 1979. The Pirates won the World Series. The Willie Steelers Stargell. Won the Super Bowl. 79 is a significant year in the Pittsburgh area, so I threw it into my handle.
Very nice. I remember those Pirate teams.
Charismatic team.
It was Parker and Stargell on that team?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Parker, Stargell.
Who was your ace?
Burt Blylevin, I guess.
Yeah.
Jim Bibby would have been at the top of that rotation. It's a really complete, balanced team. Good bullpen, Kent Tekulve. And the We Are Family Pirates.
Did you still have, Traveras was gone, right? The infield, was Bill Madlock gone at third?
No, you have a good memory. This is, they traded Traveras for Tim Foley.
Yes.
And they acquired Bill Madlock in a trade that midseason. He kind of put them over the top in the pennant race.
Al Oliver at first, or was he gone?
Al Oliver was gone.
How about Rennie Stennett?
Stennett was gone and replaced by Phil Garner.
Oh, that's right. Manny Sanguian?
Backup catcher. Manny Sanguian had a pivotal hit in Game 2 of that World Series, which he then dedicated to Roberto Clemente. So, yeah, he was definitely part of that team.
Hey, you throw that 70s baseball stuff at me.
Yeah.
Phillies, Pirates, Dodgers, Reds, I can go infields. That was great in baseball. You had stars in baseball then. That was a star-driven sport.
Yeah, well, and Joe Posnanski says this all the time, that people always believe that the greatest era of baseball was whatever era was when you were 13 years old, right? So we remember that era
That's
probably
right.
better than we remember what happened three seasons ago.
Yeah, good seeing you, Mike.
Great to see you, too. Thanks for having me.